thank you very much
for
agreeing to give us your time out of your busy schedule to talk about a movie that you made quite some time ago, but it's certainly a well-seasoned favorite, certainly one of mine. So,
it's been a while, turned into a cult movie, there's no question about that.
Yeah, it's certainly great. It's certainly, I think, unlike some of the films today, it's got a little bit of everything in it. I mean, it's got car chases, it's got action, it's got the love story, it's got the supernatural, the science fiction-y sort of element, yeah, comedy.
And it seems funnier now after 30 years than it did when we were making it.
Yeah. If we might begin a little bit for the uninitiated, could you tell us a little bit about your journey sort of prior to making the film, like how you got into the film industry?
You mean the effort to get the thing made in the first place?
Yeah, no, just a little bit about how you got your start in the film business, for one. Just for the people who are uninitiated.
Sure. I started off at Lake Tahoe, Squaw Valley.
Right.
And from there, I had done some movies that became very famous, and people knew. When that happened, I decided to go to Hollywood, and when I got to Hollywood, I realized that I didn't want to do ski movies anymore. I wanted to plug into mainstream Hollywood, and so what I did is I was with a producer by the name of Tony Bill,
right,
who had won the Academy Award for the movie The Sting.
The Sting, yes.
And he had a stable. The Sting, he had a stable of writers, of which I was one. Bruce Paltrow, Gwyneth Paltrow's father, was another one.
Right, wow.
Amongst several others. So,
right.
Yeah, that's.
So that's how you began.
That's how I started.
Right. So okay, well, let's talk about the genesis of the Wraith. What inspired you to write the script?
Originally, it was over at Disney with Kim LeMasters, who was one of the main guys at Disney at that time.
Right.
And Richard Berger, and Kim wanted it. It was originally going to be called Bonsai Runner.
Okay.
Which was around, which revolved around the car racing, that street car racing in Los Angeles at the time.
Right.
And we decided to, and then Kim saw a movie and I saw a movie called, by Clint Eastwood, called High Plains Drifter.
Oh, okay.
And in that context, we started trying to find a way to build a new story that was, it's sort of High Plains Drifter modernized.
Right. That's very interesting because it always struck me that it has the elements of the Revenge West in it, or the gunfighter that comes to town and cleans up the place.
Yeah. Mm. And so High Plains Drifter was the original inspiration, and from there I worked on the script for 3 or 4 years, and when it went into turnaround, I took it over to Buck House, executive producer on Twilight Zone.
Right.
Buck really liked the script, and he wanted to go ahead and make the movie. And he was at a company called New Century.
Right.
And in New Century production, they read the script. Steve Deutsch was the studio head at the time, and he read the script and he wanted to make it. So they pushed ahead, and that's really how it came to pass. I mean, it's a long story in between, but
right, yeah.
That's really it.
But and what sort of a budget were you working with on the film?
Well, I signed off to do the movie for $5 million.
Wow.
But we did the movie at the time. The real budget was, we shot that movie for about $2,900,000.
Wow. That's pretty incredible.
Yes.
That's very incredible, considering everything that's in it. I mean, you've got special effects, you've got...
Right.
And,
All
location shooting, I take it. Where was that all shot in? Was that all in the one town, or was it multiple locations?
No, it was shot in Tucson, Arizona.
Tucson, Arizona, yep.
Yep.
So then we moved to the casting. You had a great young cast, young Charlie Sheen, Nick Cassavetes,
right.
Sherilyn Fenn, Randy
right.
Quaid, Clint Howard. How did you, what was casting like for you? Did you have certain names that you were going after, or were you quite happy that these actors were interested to be in it?
Well, I was supposed to, I went after, I read a lot of guys, Charlie Sheen, Nick Cassavetes, Johnny Depp. My first choice was Johnny Depp to play the Minty role.
Right.
Minty character was taken from George Roll,
George Miller's Road Warrior. I liked the name from the little feral boy. His name was Emil Minty.
All right, yes.
So I named him Minty.
Minty, yeah. Minty, yeah. And
Emil Minty.
Yes, yeah. He played the feral kid.
The feral kid.
Yeah, in the Road Warrior.
So I named him that, and I cast Johnny Depp.
Okay.
And the studio said no to Johnny Depp.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. That wouldn't happen today.
I said, this guy, Johnny Depp, can really act.
Yeah.
And they said they wanted Griffin O'Neill instead.
Right.
So it was a losing battle.
How wrong they were, hey. They didn't fancy Johnny at the time, hey?
Correct.
Right. So Charlie Sheen, he was a rising star. How did Charlie get involved? Was he suggested next, or?
Right. Charlie was always at the top of the list, and so at Nick Cassavetes Red, he was at the top of the list.
Right.
After 30 plus years, Nick and I are still partners.
Oh wow. Yeah, because Nick went on to direct as well too, hasn't he?
Yeah, he became a big-time Hollywood director.
Yeah. And, of course, Sherilyn Fenn, before she went on to Twin Peaks
right.
fame. And
Sherilyn Fenn was my last choice.
Really? Who did you...
Yeah, I had Melora Hardin, and I had Leslie Hope. I had two other very beautiful young women. I couldn't find the fifth, but the studio had Deutsch wanted five girls on the tape.
Right.
So I went for the... although Sherilyn was beautiful, she couldn't act, and so because she couldn't act, I put her in the tape knowing that she'd be rejected. The problem was Deutsch, the head of the studio, loved her.
Okay.
The irony is the woman I wanted the least got the role because the studio insisted on it.
Right. And Randy Quaid you had as well from The Sheriff. How did Randy get involved?
Right. Randy Quaid was at the top of his game. He was playing the lead in Saturday Night. He was one of the regulars on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And in Saturday Night Live, Randy flew out every Monday to work with us. Lauren Green let him off to come work with us.
Right.
And I would personally go to the airport to pick him up.
Okay.
And drive the set.
Right.
Tell me no director ever did anything like that for him before.
So he was very grateful to you.
And he and I became great friends after that.
Right.
But I don't know where he is now. He's fallen off the face of the earth.
Yeah. You had a young Ronnie Howard's brother, Clint, in there as well.
Clint Howard, yeah. Clint.
Great.
Like a part of Rugrat, as you know.
Yeah, great character actor.
Yeah, he was a great character actor, and yeah. We all loved him.
So tell us a little bit about the production.
Well, the production, I signed to do the movie in 30 days.
Yeah.
And I didn't have one of the great producers of all time. I had a guys who were not, they didn't really care about the movie. They just really were not into the movie, actually.
Right.
They were taking kickbacks from various department heads.
Right.
There was a lot of hanky-panky going on behind the scenes.
Ooh.
So the movie was budgeted at $5 million, and I was at least almost $2 million under budget with that.
Right.
At one point, the lead accountant of the movie walked into my hotel room, and he says, "Why are you pushing this production? You're so far under budget, you could go another 2 or 3 weeks."
Wow.
And I said, "I'm not pushing it. It was the producer. The producer had another commitment to do another movie in Canada."
Right. And so was it a smooth production?
No,
tumultuous?
No, it was not.
It wasn't?
Difficult. Every single day was difficult.
Yeah.
Mostly because I had a producer that made my life miserable every single day.
Right.
And then on the end of the big deal on the race is that when we broke the second unit,
yeah,
on the second day of shooting second unit,
yeah,
we crashed an insert car, and one of the cameramen sitting in my camera position was killed.
Oh no, I wasn't aware. That's terrible. Yes.
So it's the irony that that movie became a cult movie with fan clubs all over the world. The guy's cars selling them for $600,000-$700,000 each today. There's irony in all that.
Yes, yes. But I mean, on the other side of that, working with this wonderful cast you assembled, was there must have been some joy in
right.
that.
It was really a lot of fun work. Look, if movies were just about blocking out scenes and acting and doing that would really be great, but it was so much more than that.
Yeah, so, I mean, you obviously, the film revolves a lot around the car sequences. Was that
right.
In, I guess the smart thing in scheduling would be to do all that together, like all of the, there, is that how you approach that? In different...
No, it was shot all through Sun, Arizona.
Right.
And what's interesting is the hamburger stand in the movie
yes.
was something like a mile outside town.
Right.
Now 2 miles outside of town.
Right.
Tucson expanded so dramatically that it's unrecognizable to what it was.
Yeah.
It was actually a beauty parlor that we converted into a hamburger stand, and there's been a few high-profile producers have called me and asked me where that location is.
Right.
But it doesn't exist. We built it.
Okay, wow. What was it like wrangling or getting together all the vehicles? Did you have a particular...
My transportation guy was a guy named Gary Hellerstein, and he was a very well-organized guy.
Right.
And he did a great job of making sure I had everything I needed. And what's really funny is at the end of the movie, we took all the cars in the movie and rented this great big polo field or this big track. I don't remember exactly what it was, and we had a demolition derby.
Wow.
With all the cars in the movie.
That's cool.
And we destroyed all the cars.
Wow. And the actual vehicle that the Wraith drives, was that was obviously customized for the film?
Actually, it belonged to Pittsburgh Paint and Glass.
Okay.
And it was the pace car. It was the pace car for the Indianapolis 500.
Really?
And we went to Detroit and met with the auto manufacturers, and one of them knew where all the molds for the car were located.
Right.
So in the actual running cars in the movie,
wow.
We used Volkswagens, and what you see running is a Volkswagen.
Wow.
With that looks exactly like the Pittsburgh PP&G pace car.
Wow.
And we did use the Pittsburgh PP&G car on a few scenes.
Yeah.
But it was so highly insured, and it was $4.5 million
wow.
in 1985 money.
Yeah. Wow.
We had to be so careful with it.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. I mean, I are you familiar with the director Brian Trenchard Smith?
I am not. Say, what's his name again?
Brian Trenchard Smith.
No, I don't.
Yeah, but no, I just mentioned it because he made a film out here last year, and it was an action movie where there was, you know, like yours, a lot of explosions and whatnot. But the cars that they had in the movie, they weren't allowed to damage. For similar insurance reasons. So he said it was really difficult having to, you know, because usually in action movies, there's, you know, you can't always guarantee that everything's going to go the right way. So he said it was every time, you know, they'd stop and do a take and check the car and make sure there were no scratches or irreplaceable.
One of the things about the race is I wanted to emulate George Miller's Road Warrior.
Yes.
And if you look at the way I structured the crashes, and if you look at the way we went through George Miller's Road Warrior frame by frame, literally,
yes.
frame by frame.
Yes.
And we discovered how he cut his movie together, and we did the same thing. And I did that, on a couple of movies.
Yeah. Yeah, I did notice that, like, you liked some of George's angles and the way the cars get, some of the crashes and whatnot, I noticed were very Road Warrior-esque.
They were very Road Warriors. Yes.
Yeah, but so the working, I mean, there was obviously a lot of elements where you had to tie together with the special effects involving the Wraith's car. How was that all done? What effects?
Unbeknownst to me, the special effects foreman was a very nice gentleman. The problem was he was functionally illiterate.
Okay.
And so we did not know he could not read or write English.
Okay.
He used a translator, and that caused me a lot of trouble because I would say what I wanted.
Right.
And it would be written down, and somebody else would translate it for him. Say, well, this is what the director wants.
Yes.
So little did I know that everything I was saying, the guy, if I sent him a memo, he didn't read it. He didn't know what it was. So that made him steadily head.
Wow. You know, it was very, the whole film is visually impressive with the vistas out there in the desert and
right.
The high desert, as they say. very, very picturesque, very cinematic. What was it? I mean, I guess temperature-wise, was they always talk about the weather conditions on movies. What was the weather forgiving or unforgiving?
Well, it was cold in Tucson. It snowed one night when we were doing a scene with Charlie and Sherilyn coming home. The weather was generally cold.
Really?
But it wasn't impossible. It was not impossible to work.
Okay, right. Yeah, because I suppose it's the extremes out there. It gets cold at night out there in the desert, doesn't it?
Yes, it drops below freezing, and a simple rain will turn into snow, and that's what happens.
Wow. Yes, much unlike it is down under. Here out in the desert, it just stays hot. I really love your script. You've got some great exchanges in the movie. One of my favorite lines is from The Wraith, where Cassavetes turns to, I think it's Dave Sherrill as Skank, and he says, get rid of that zombie piss you're drinking before it turns you into a mushroom.
Right. Before it turns you into a mushroom. Yeah,
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that was one of, I like that line. That was one of the lines I liked.
I've got to ask, I remember reading about another film where an actor had to drink, he was actually drinking from a lighter fluid bottle, and the director, for effect, put vinegar in there, so when he drank it, he didn't know there was vinegar in it, so when he drank it, that gave him the gasp, as one would. I just wondered with Dave, what was in the bottles, when he was drinking his lubricants and his...
Oh, that's a good question. The WD-40 and all that wasn't any... that was just sugar water.
Oh, okay. I wondered if you might have slipped something in there for effect.
Dave was really a good actor, and Jamie, they were really good actors. They were able to pull that out without, they could act it out.
Yeah. Because I just wondered if you might have sort of slipped something in there for effect, so when he took a big chug of it, when he took a chug of it, he might have got something that he wasn't expecting.
Wouldn't it have been funny if you could trace Charlie's life back to me giving him something on the right?
But it's full of, it's full of incredible, car sequences right from the get-go. You filmed at night and during the day. What were all those, what was it like to film all those chases, all those races? Was it...
What about it?
What was it like to film all of those race sequences? Was it...
That's when the nightmarish part of
accident,
the production commenced.
Right.
I had signed off on my production 18 days to shoot second unit.
Right.
And John Kemeny, the producer, had, unbeknownst to me, committed to do another movie, and he accelerated. So the whole movie, everything you see in that movie, action-wise, was shot in 8 single days.
Wow.
8 days we shot all that.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
And when the crash happened,
terrible.
The politics on the picture became as ugly as they can be.
Oh, that's terrible. It's terrible. It was not, in all the things I've read about the film, I was not aware of that. That's terrible. But
I could actually elaborate that on that a little bit better for you some other time. But yeah, that was really a very painful period doing the second unit on that, because those guys, they just pushed the production unnecessarily and they didn't need to.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's shocking to hear that it went that way, because it has indeed become very, certainly a very cherished film that I certainly very cherish a great deal, because it has such a, you just don't see today, it's got such a great blend of all these different elements.
Right.
And
I would love a chance to remake The Wraith.
Yeah.
The scenes that weren't in it. One of the basic underlying plot lines was that Randy Quaid enlisted the talents of a prairie witch.
Okay.
To help him, a prairie witch.
Yes.
To help him solve the problem of what he was dealing with.
Right.
And Kemeny made me redline all those scenes because they didn't want to take the extra days to shoot him.
Right, yeah.
But it was
would have been really cool.
Yeah. I mean, was there a lot of stuff that you did film that you excised for time and pacing, or?
There were a few things, yeah. There were a few things that I filmed that I really liked that did not make the final cut, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, mostly everything got up there.
Right. And as far as the transition from the script that you originally wrote to what film that you made, I mean, did you, as they say, murder your darlings? Did you excise a lot from your, or have to change a lot from your original script in the journey from your initial writing to when you went into production?
The only thing I really had to change was for production purposes. I had to excise a total of 16 pages, which would have been about 4 or 5 days shooting.
Right.
I had to excise 15 pages of the explanation of what was happening, the Prairie Witch.
Oh, okay, right.
It really told what was really happening in the witch. So Randy knew what he was up against. He knew he was up against supernatural
something strange,
force.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's not in the movie that I really wanted was there was no steering wheel in the car, in the Wraith car.
Right.
Charlie would just reach into the dashboard.
Right.
And then you would cut into the inside of the dashboard, and you would see a universe with a billion stars, and then out of the firmament, a hand would blast through into darkness and steer the car through time and space without a steering wheel.
Right.
All that was cut out of the vision.
Oh, wow. That sounds really... That'd be something you could really make a meal of today with all these computer effects and whatnot.
Right.
You could really explore that quite well today with all the advances in special effects,
right,
and whatnot.
That's true enough.
Mm. But
I regret that enormously.
Yeah, that sounds like it would have been really incredible. No, that again would have added yet another sort of element to it, like the science fiction supernatural sort of element to the whole thing.
Right.
A couple of my favorite sequences I've always wanted to sort of ask you about. I love the I always sort of love how Randy Quaid initially seems sort of bothered when he has to sort of take off, you know, like he at one point he's sitting there just about to have a hamburger and he gets the call like, oh, there's another crash out on the highway. And I love the bit where he's sort of walking, I think this is after Augie Fisher is killed.
Foggy Fisher, yeah.
Yeah, and right. I love how he's sort of walking along the line, like they're all standing there by side the side of the road, and he's got that line, you know, nobody seems too cut up about Mr. Fisher, you know. That kid was maggot pie before he hit the canyon floor. he's got that sort of great, almost sort of a little bit of a faux sort of John Wayne thing going there.
Yeah, he was just a little bit laconic about it.
Yeah.
He was, nobody seems to be too broken up about Augie Fisher lying up there in pieces.
Yeah. Was that,
I want to know which one of you guys.
Yeah. Was that whole concept of the fact when they were pulled out of the wreck, like clean, except for their eyes, that was my
thing where, you know, I was just trying to emphasize that this wasn't your natural fire and brimstone. When you died here, everything burned except for you.
Right.
And whatever you saw went with you.
Right.
Your eyes were burned out and your body was unscathed.
Yeah.
Not a mark on them. Remember, some guy says, hey, there's not a mark on them.
And another element
that comes out of the open,
yeah. Yeah. Another element, too, you notice in the flashbacks is that Charlie Sheen's character is actually played by a different actor in the flashback when he was murdered.
Yeah, I used another actor in the flashback, but that was on purpose.
Right.
Because Charlie Sheen came back as the Wraith.
Yeah.
But in real life, he was Jamie Hankin's brother.
Okay.
And they just looked different, and you know that made perfect sense.
Right.
But we did use a double. Charlie had gone on to do the movie Platoon.
Right.
And so I had to use a double for a couple of things.
Right. You know, because there's that element, because when he first meets Sherilyn, who obviously knew him before, he appears slightly different to her. Like she knows who he is, but she doesn't know who she is. You know, so he's got that slightly...
That's right.
Yeah.
I was just trying to... You know, I was just trying to have fun with those concepts.
Yeah. No, it's
that was all about having fun and making. They were all red herrings, but it was mainly to have fun.
Another sequence I like is that great. It looks like a graveyard of old aircraft.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, the aircraft graveyard.
Yeah, that's a great location.
That's terrific. That's terrific.
And 30 years ago when we did it, that graveyard had 1,000 Vietnam-era planes, and it had World War II and Korean War stuff. Right now, all that stuff is gone.
Yeah.
But I did the movie 3,000 Miles to Graceland. I went down there, and we had to struggle to find a good plane.
Right. Well, did you say you worked on 3,000 Miles to Graceland?
Yeah, I was the uncredited head of special effects on the movie.
Really?
I'll tell you about that in another interview.
But that's fortuitous because I just recently interviewed Damien Lichtenstein who directed.
Yeah, Damien was the director. I was the special effects guy.
Wow. Okay. Wow. I didn't know that. There you go. 6 degrees, right there. Because I only recently interviewed Damien. So that's great. But the film's got a great look. Your director of photography was a gentleman named Reed. Is it Reed Smoot? Yeah.
Yes.
Worked on another sort of cult sort of 80s movie, Gleaming the Cube. Obviously, you were well in sync with him. He gave.
No, I was Reed. I had known Reed since the early 70s when I was making ski movies. I actually ran into him while he was doing a snowmobile documentary.
Okay.
And during that period, we became friends. He became a friend of mine, and I had great respect for him. But when we did the raid, he wasn't very supportive as a DP.
Okay.
And he made it very difficult for me on set every single day, and he was not very helpful. He was just a bad. My experience with Reed was not a good experience.
Okay.
I wanted to do this beautiful movie, and I could never get Reed to, give me some, how are we doing? What is it? And he'd say, he'd just shake his head and say, this is what happens when you don't have enough money. We're really fucking, this is a fucking mess, this movie. And he was so judgmental, and there was nothing I could do about it, and I couldn't change.
Right.
That I needed to have a team behind me that was really behind me, and Reed was not, and that became very, very difficult for me to believe.
Well, you've spoken a little bit about the unpleasant story of the production. Are there any fun stories, anecdotes that you look back fondly upon?
Yeah, I mean, when I look back on it, and I think of some of the, some of the second unit stuff was really a lot of fun shooting and creating those. I had some really great, I studied the Road Warrior really, really carefully, and it was so much fun to try and outdo George Miller. I mean, nobody can outdo George Miller, but I was trying to outdo George Miller.
Well, I think you did a fantastic job. Like I said, there was the tragedy, but are there any amusing anecdotes that you remember?
One amusing thing is that during the production, Sherilyn Fenn was supposed to get naked and do this hot love scene with Charlie Sheen, and it turned out that when we shot it on the third day, and she refused to do any nudity,
right.
And she said, "No, I'm not going to do it." And know that she was a prince. She was one of Prince's female protege.
Okay.
And we didn't know that, and I didn't know the whole time we were shooting the movie. Johnny Depp was living in her hotel room. The whole time, I had no idea.
Really? Wow. The guy that you wanted initially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sherilyn was his girlfriend.
Wow, okay. So he was there for the shoot anyway.
Yeah, he was there anyway, and, was my loss then, because I really loved Johnny. I thought he was a terrific actor, and I didn't know he was going to be such a big, huge star, but I knew he had it in him.
Yeah.
But, it's hard to reflect back on, with amusing. There were, it wasn't that kind of a movie. Like when we did Hot Dog, Hot Dog was, now that movie was funny and crazy, and
right,
every day was filled with craziness and fun stories.
Yeah.
On the raid, it was a grind getting it, shot by shot.
Yeah.
And it was my first real movie. So,
right, yeah.
I was a first-time director, and I got control, and I was always at the whim, and, somebody, the producer, tapping his watch as if I'm going
Yeah.
Very, very difficult. I felt like, you know, Francis Coppola probably felt on The Godfather when they were just making his life miserable.
Yeah.
They have a way of doing that when you're really are passionate about something, and that's kind of what the experience was for me.
Yeah. Well, it was a very audacious debut, I must say. But so how did shooting wraps up? So how was post-production then? Was post-production a minefield, or did that go smoothly for you? Or?
The editor on the movie was Scott Conrad, who won the Oscar.
For Rocky, that's right.
For Rocky.
Yep.
Right. And he quit about before there was a director's cut. He quit before I had a cut.
Okay.
And the assistant editor took over the movie. And so, but generally everything was okay. Richard Portman, who had done the mix on The Deer Hunter, he was the genius behind the sound. But even in post-production, John Kemeny, the producer, exerted an enormous amount of influence day to day on how, you know, it's like there was this, when Audie Fisher was killed and they put him into the ambulance, I had the Clancy Troutman, I said, put some flies buzzing so we know that there's flies, you know, that he's dead and he's already attracting flies.
Right.
And Kemeny said, no, take him out. That's bad taste. And I'm going, wait a minute, it's a movie, you know. So I had those kinds of, and then the Kemeny assigned this girl named Jolene Cherry as music supervisor, and she did not like Richard Portman, who had won an Oscar for The Deer Hunter.
Right.
Probably one of the funniest and most amusing scenes that happened in the whole production happened on the dubbing stage. And
really?
She made fun of Richard Portman. He was very religious and a Buddhist.
Right.
And every morning he would say his Buddhist prayers, and then he would do the mix. He was just this very eccentric, enormously talented human being.
Right.
And she would make fun of him.
Right.
And she was relentless about it. And one day we walked onto the dubbing stage, and he had all 11 Academy Award nominations laid out on the dubbing console, including his Oscar.
Wow. Wow.
And she never said another thing to him after that.
Wow.
That's one of my really beautiful memories of you know, that post-production period.
That's great. That's almost a little bit like when Greg Toland walked up to Orson Welles and asked him if he wanted to shoot Citizen Kane, and he reached into his bag and pulled out his Academy Award for Wuthering Heights and said, you know, Mr. Welles, I want to shoot your picture. You know? when in doubt, pull out your Oscar, eh?
Well, that's what Shelley Winters did. Same thing when she was being cast in one of her last movies.
Yeah.
She said, well, are you sure she can act? And finally she walked in with both Oscars and sat them down on the table in front of her and said, now would you like me to read this again? Kind of the same thing happened on The Wraith with Richard Portman. He was a great guy, a talented mixer, and this little 23-year-old girl was just made his life a living hell.
Wow.
And in the end, those are my, unfortunately, my stories revolve around that sort of vibe rather than an Animal House kind of thing.
Right. But I always loved the score. I remember getting the score
right
on tape by J. Peter Robinson, who, of course, went on to some other big movies. But so what was
he
it
was
like?
He was in Phil Collins' group.
Right, yeah. And in one of the profiles I read, said he toured with Tangerine Dream as well at one point. But
I knew Peter Bauman from Tangerine Dream really well. He was one of the original founders.
Right.
Until you just mentioned it, I had no idea that J. Peter Robinson would be connected to Tangerine Dream.
Yeah. No. I don't think Peter was. I think it was is it Honig?
Yes.
He was the music supervisor. Yeah.
Right.
But
Michael Honig.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He was the he and J. Peter Robinson were the composers on record.
Yeah. When you handed in your cut, did you have to make a lot of vast changes?
I had to make some changes, but I did not have to make many. I didn't get a whole lot of notes.
Right.
They gave me some notes, and they were non-decisive notes. They didn't really do anything. The biggest problem I had in the post was with Scotty Brothers record and Jolene Cherry, the music supervisor who insulted Richard Portman.
Right.
Those were the biggest problems I had.
Right.
And, you know, that was really basically it.
And how did the...
It was a relatively drama-free post, except for what I just told you about.
Right. And how did the film do on its initial release back then?
The movie opened... for some reason, the movie was never tracked by New Century Productions. I think it opening weekend at about, I don't know, if I remember correctly, I don't hold into it, but I think it did about $1.5 million on 600 screens or 4 million. I forget exactly what it was.
Yeah.
It didn't appear that the race was going to be the success it eventually became.
Right.
Really, for a number of years.
Yeah, but do you think it...
people really started gravitating toward the movie.
Yeah.
That was...
Do you think, like, a lot of films... Do you think, like, a lot of films of its kind, it found its audience on home video?
I think that's true of The Race, even.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it found its audience through home video.
Yeah.
And kids would play it, you know, at home. And, you know, I mean, I've heard for years and years and years how it was, some kids, it was their favorite movie when they were kids.
Oh, certainly. You're speaking to one of those tonight, sir. What, definitely right up. I can remember very vividly when it came out on video. It had this wonderful, I don't know how to describe it to you. It had almost like a holographic type cover. Obviously, it has the lead character of the film sort of front and center on the cover, but it had like this translucent sort of holographic film over it, so when you tilted it in the light, like his visor would, the character's visor would gleam, and like all of the sort of the mechanical sort of parts of his costume, you know, would glint and all sorts of stuff. It was a very flash video cover.
Yeah.
I remember. So it sort of
apparently Lionsgate did a DVD Blu-ray release of it in the last few years.
Right.
I've never looked at it.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of interviews in that. I don't know if you saw them or not.
No, I'm still trying to get a hold of it because the Region 4 release doesn't have any extras at all. But I'm still trying to get a hold of the Region 1, which has, I believe, has a commentary of yours on it.
Yes, the commentary, which I've never seen. I'd like to see, actually.
Yeah, so I'm still trying to get a hold of that. That was only a Region 1 that was not released down here. The one down here has only got, like, the trailer and stuff on it. It doesn't have any features at all, really.
You really, if you can get hold of it, it'll give you a little extra insight.
Yeah.
And if you like, I'll follow up with you.
Listen, sir, for your time today, it's been, as a fan first and foremost, it's been a real treat finally getting to have a word with the director of The Wraith. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you very much for giving me so generously.
Absolutely, thank you.
Yeah, it's been...
Stay in touch.
Yeah, I will.